Now we move to agenda paper 10, I believe. Kez, can you make this one boring, please?
Yes. So, agenda paper 10. In May, the committee received a request seeking clarification on paragraph 93 of IS 19. The standard was issued in last year and will be effective from annual periods beginning on or after 1st January next year. According to the submitter, the paragraph 93 was intended to address measurement of the net defined benefit obligation if the risk of plan is shared with employees through the contributions to the plan. However, the submitter is concerned that the guidance would affect any plan with employee contribution, and that may result in a change in measurement of the net DBO for all of those plans. So we conducted outreach to the International Forum of Accounting Standard Setters, as well as the ISB's Employee Benefits Group, a Benefits Working Group. We received 19 responses, and the summary and details are included in this paper. In determining whether paragraph 93 is intended to be a clarification or intended to be a change in measurement, we started our analysis with looking at the discussion made at the ISB meeting back in February 2011. At that meeting, the ISB discussed various aspects of risk-sharing features based on comments received from the exposure draft at the time. In our view, requirements in the exposure draft and the ISB's decision for that meeting, and also paragraph 93 of IS 19-2011, are all consistent. They all require employee contribution should be considered in calculating the DBO. And such employee contributions comprise expected future contributions relating to employee past service and do not include future contributions that relate to entirely to future service. We think that kind of requirement is theoretically correct because the measurement of the DBO should include those future contributions before the reporting date. Ignoring such contributions that relate to past service will impair the concept of accrual accounting. So employee contributions linked to employee service are part of the funding of the total benefits paid to employees. In other words, the ultimate cost and therefore risk of a plan is shared between employees and employer. In addition, such contributions has an effect of reducing service costs for the corresponding periods. And therefore, the cost included in profit or loss should be only the entity's share and not the total cost of the total benefit. On the basis of these analysis, we think paragraph 93 is just a clarification of the requirements in the old IS 19, I mean current IS 19. Employee contributions that relate to past service will be considered in determining DBO, and as a consequence, employee contributions will be attributed to periods of service as a negative benefit, and as a result, the benefit net of employee contributions will be attributed to periods of service. I think the whole intention or whole purpose of this exercise was to ensure the timing of payment of contribution does not affect the allocation of cost. Having said that, we acknowledge general concerns. It is not clear how to account for employee contributions, and this might cause divergent interpretations. Therefore, we recommend the committee choose option 2 in my paper and provide guidance based on the staff analysis in this paper. I want to add one thing. I have just received further analysis from the submitter this morning as to how to apply paragraph 93 and effectively paragraph 70. I think that will help develop guidance in future. But considering the impact that may have on current practice, I would like to have the views and guidance from the committee on this issue.
Any takers? Sure, Lawrence. I got to separate the two of you.
Yeah, this is a difficult topic, which can give you a big headache. Yes, I do read, like you do, that employees' contributions should be taken now. The question is, how do you take them into account? And we know, and I know, that the Dutch Accounting Standards Board has released guidance, and it's translated into English, where they offer two views how to account for it. It's either you project everything, or you just project and straight-line those employees' contributions relating to future salary increases. And so, so there is already divergent views, even if you go along the view that you would include those future employee contributions into the calculation. What bothers me a little bit more is if any rejection or any work that would say that this was already the requirement in the previous IS 19, because it didn't seem so clear to me that this was what was already required. And anyway, your outreach shows that almost everybody was not accounting for this like the way you wanted to have. It is true that taking those employees' contribution into the measurement of the DBO, and again, as I said, how do you do so, complicates the matter quite significantly, and that the current accounting, when you just deduct employees' contribution from the service cost, is quite an easy way to deal with. So, you were asking questions and options about how we should move forward on this. I would reject your option one, which is to reject the issue because of the ISB intention is clear. Because as I said already, currently people, even if people would agree with your analysis, they don't know how to do it. So if you go for option two, provide guidance to clarify more the ISB's intention, I think you would need practical examples to really explain. And as I said, there are already divergent views how you would do that implementation, so it's worth looking at it. And your option three, I have sympathy as well. Because I know the complexity that is being raised in implementing the consideration of employees' contribution into the measurement of the DBO.
Joanna?
Well, I was going to jump straight to your question, and I'm probably, I won't say completely opposite to Laurence, but slightly, in that I do see that I don't necessarily have a preference for one, but I think that there are some options which aren't necessarily your A, B, and C, which is that to do a rejection notice, but actually to provide clarity as opposed to simply it's obvious because this is what the ISB intended. So to somehow, you know, add some real value to it, which I think perhaps does, you know, i.e. what we really think, and I can't think of the right words. Option two, in terms of the examples, I do not support doing examples. I do not personally, this is a personal thing, I don't think adding guidance like that is an appropriate way to do it, because effectively by having to give examples, it proves that the standard itself isn't clear. And to me, I would rather get the standard clear, which comes to my third option, which is there anything we can do in the offending paragraph to actually make a tweak, an improvement to the offending paragraph to actually give the clarity, around what the board did intend. So to me, the two options are do a rejection notice and provide the clarity, or actually to, provide the clarity in the paragraph by changing a few words. Don't ask me how, but.
Others? Luca?
I'm not really convinced that the new paragraphs say exactly the same elements of the previous accounting and also the outsource indicate that could be different interpretation. With reference to the option, my best will be for option 3, even though I'm very scared and worried about the timing, because next year we have to apply this and entities are working during this month in order to prepare the first application of the new standards in order to prepare the future interim period. And so any action that we will take or that we want to take should be carefully considering the time constraint that we have. And in order to avoid the effect to have a grammatical change in the previous, also consider it if the clarification that we could produce will have a prospective application rather than a retrospective application. These are the practical issue that I see now is this. In general, during period starting from September to December, entities are working with their actuarials in order to prepare the figures for the next financial statements and for the 2013.
Cash?
Yes. I read the staff paper and I understand theoretically, but as Ron's pointed out, the current practice is just simply deduct from the current service cost. I'm not clear it's worthwhile to change the current practice. There might be some issue for certain jurisdictions, but from preparer's perspective, developing the guidance and make it more complicated practice is not question is really relevant or useful thing to do so. Regarding the option, I prefer maybe hopefully option 3 to go back to the ISP's intention, hoping not to change the majority of the current practice.
The only question that I would put back to you is, you could reach the conclusion that what you describe as current practice wasn't consistent with the old standard and not with the new standard either. So if we did go back to the board, there's the possibility that the board would say, oh yeah, we want to change practice. Yeah. So I guess we have to accept that risk if we think that we want to go back to the board. John?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that that the accounting is an unintended consequence. So I would support up the recommendation that we look to provide some guidance on how it can be applied. It seems to me that option 3, going back and amending it, is a standard that's just being amended and gone through a process, and I don't see evidence that there's an unintended consequence of that amendment. So it seems to me that the appropriate thing for us to do would be to try and provide some guidance on the application of that paragraph.
John?
I think we should do something with it, and I think also time is of the essence. So between option 1, 2, and 3, I could go with either one, as long as the rejection does something. Maybe it's not the appropriate way to do it, anyhow. But I think we should do it. We should use a channel that will provide the guidance in a timely fashion. And maybe that means 2, but if it's option 3 and we can get it quickly, that will be my favorite approach.
The difference between 1, 2, and 3 is 1 and 2 do not compel a change. The examples in the standards do not compel a change in accounting policy. So CAS's objective of saying, well, you can help, but don't, preparers have already worked this out, neither one nor two would do, would compel a change. If we go back to the board, it would. So that might enter into your thinking as well. Andrew?
Sorry, just to be clear, what would we go back to the board and ask them what they meant, or to go back to the old accounting? What we're calling the old accounting.
Well, I'm struggling because the only thing I can think of Joanna's going to hate, which is the amending language, would be something that would begin, for example, and would, I guess, be more specific on exactly what the intent was and whether there's an unintended consequence or not.
Sorry, John, I don't think there is an unintended consequence here, and I think the chances of the board saying, going back to where practice was, aren't too high.
Let me make one more observation, and then bring Sandy in. This is, to my knowledge, the first time that we've entertained the idea of developing examples or education guidance or things like that. One of the reasons why I think we opened up that possibility is they are more likely to be accessible than our agenda rejection notices have typically been. You know, our agenda rejection notices haven't aged well. And something like this would, I assume, be reproduced in the Green Book every year and become part of the body, whereas our rejection notices aren't as accessible. But, Sandy?
I guess my question was, I didn't feel like one was the right answer, but two or three. But do you have to make a decision between two and three today, or can you pursue what you think might be clarifying or do more research and then make a decision? Because as I read this, and you know, this particular provision of IS 19, I'm not an expert at, but as I read this, I found the respondents didn't address everything in the same way. And I found it challenging to parse out, I knew what the major issue was, but there were sub-issues, risk sharing, and is it dependent on service costs? And I found myself trying to organize my thoughts as to where the dependencies were. And it seemed to me that it needed some clarification, because the notion that people were just going to ignore it and do what they'd done in the past, when in fact that might not have been the intention, seemed troubling to me. So to me it seemed like, do I have to decide between two and three today, or can we do more work and then decide between two and three?
Well, certainly I would say the first thing that the committee will need to do is to agree on how IS 19 should be applied in respect of these items. And then once having made that agreement, then yes, you could then take the decision between option two and option three. What would be the most efficient, most expedient way of communicating that conclusion that you reach?
I have to say that the examples in Appendix B didn't help me to resolve that.
I would agree.
they seem to be designed instead to support a particular view, and I wasn't absolutely sure that they helped me resolve the issue. One thing we can certainly do is to, I think, take Sandy's proposal and do both, develop some examples, and then, based on that, ask the committee if we need additional language in the standard that would implement those examples, or whether they can draw from the standard itself. Is that a reasonable next step, Michael?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Do I see any objection to that? None appearing? That's what we'll do.
One question, I apologize.
Sure.
The plans we're talking about are unusual in my experience, to have employees contribute to a defined benefit plan, particularly when the contribution is solely related to service. I mean, I certainly understand where you can transfer some of the investment risk, and that might lead to employee contributions. But here we're talking about employee contributions that are solely related to service. What is the difference between an employee contribution tied to service and just paying the employee less and having the employer make a larger contribution? Isn't that the same, and shouldn't we get the same answer? Am I missing something?
Yes, there would be a difference, I think. And one just springs to mind in terms of then the level of pensionable salary. And your pensionable salary would then be...
And if that's set by law, it makes a difference. If it's set by contract, you just alter the terms of the contract. I mean, I was just thinking this through in my head. And it felt like to me, let's say you got a plan where the employer contributes 3% of salary towards the pension plan, which actually the only one I know of that's like that in the United States happens to be the U.S. government pension plan. But so the employee contributes 3% of salary into the plan. Well, that seems economically to be the same as the employee only gets paid 97 cents and the employer makes the same contribution. If that were the case, then the employer's reported compensation expense would simply be reduced by 3%. And seems like we ought to get about the same answer, which I think leads me back to wanting to get the answer where the employee contributions are simply deducted from service cost for the period. Am I looking at it, thinking about it too simply?
It's a dangerous question in 19.
Yes, but I do have a simple mind.
So let me clarify. So in the example, employee is contributing 3%, and the employer is contributing 97%.
No, the employee is contributing 3% of his salary, and the employer is contributing whatever the employer has to contribute to get the defined benefit.
So that 3% is going to decrease the cost, allocated cost in profit or loss. But from a liability perspective, the DBO will be 100% because the employer has to pay 100%, including employee contributions.
See, now you're getting more complicated than my mind was allowing me to get. I was just trying to think economically. You know, if we pay the employee 100,000 euros and say you have to contribute 3% of your salary to your defined benefit pension, isn't that the same as paying the employee 97,000 euros and saying you don't have to contribute anything to your defined benefit pension?
Well, and I think Kaz's answer is it depends, because if the employee, it depends on whether or not the employee's contribution changes the defined benefit. If the employer still has to provide a targeted defined benefit.
Right, and that's what I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But, and maybe that's where I'm missing, and maybe I'm not understanding the plans. I thought that the plans that were causing trouble are not the ones where there's risk sharing on returns. Everybody seems to agree that you take that into account. It's the ones where the future employee contributions are solely related to service. Joanna and I agree that's usually a bad sign.
Yeah. I'll refrain from talking about simple-minded, having referred to myself that way earlier. Look, let's get this back here and on the basis that I described, and let's see some example, what we think the examples that we would include look like.
Okay.
And at the same, and first get the committee to agree that that's in fact what they think the standard requires, and then we can make a decision between whether or not that's the best way or whether there's some additional words that we can add to the standard that will operationalize that.
Okay.
Okay.